Part-time fanboy, and we are part-time fanboys, Christian, Paul, and Ian, and we are here to talk about, what are we going to start with? 10 Cent Plague, Ian? Is that what we should start with? You've got a book review?
Sure.
All right, why don't you start?
I'd love to get right into it.
Cool.
Have you guys heard about this book before?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I have a friend who's read it, and he recommended it highly.
I've been dying to read it, and I was going to buy it a couple of years ago, but when I went on Amazon, it was completely sold out, and there were no like resellers selling it, so I just have never gone back and picked it up. But you actually read the whole thing.
I read the whole thing, and I found it in a store in the Valley. I went in because I think I was the nice thing about that location of that store, which is on Ventura Boulevard, is it's right down the street from the mall.
So wait, which store?
I think it was Earth 2.
Earth 2,
Reseda,
yeah.
I don't know. Is it Reseda or Sherman Oaks?
No, that's in Sherman Oaks. They have one in Sherman Oaks, and then they have one close to me, kind of like in the Reseda area on Reseda Boulevard. So that one's...
us non-Valley people, it all sounds the same.
Yeah, I know. So there's two different locations, but I have a feeling that you went to the Sherman Oaks location.
I did, and it's a nice store because it's very historical in some ways, and you wouldn't really find 10 Cent Plague in just every store, but I found it next to the Scott McCloud books, which I love, and I was just like, I'm going to try this out. So I wrote this little book report about the book.
Yeah.
And after I spit it out, we could just rap about it for a bit. So
yeah, go for it.
Full name of the book is called The 10 Cent Plague, The Great Comic Book Scare and How It Changed America. And I want to give the URL. It's the author's website, David Hajdu. I hope I'm saying that right. It's
Hajdu.
Hajdu. Hajdu. I don't know. I hope I'm saying it right. I'm probably not. So it's www.davidhajdu.com, and then under books is the 10 Cent Plague.
Cool.
So the nice thing about entertainment is that if you don't have to really delve into history or know what history to enjoy a story, whether it's comics or movies or TV or interpretive dance. If you want, you could watch a particular show, movie, etc., and you don't really have to know every little thing about the history of it. So you don't have to learn about every nook and cranny about history, but if you're like me and you were lucky and you started reading comics in middle school and the first book you read was The Dark Knight Returns. So from that, I guess, just from that historical context.
Is that really the first comic book you ever read?
That was like the first book I ever sat down and read. I had maybe an Aquaman or a Captain America or a Hulk here and there, but someone's like caught me very early, very early.
Was it, not to get off track, but... being the first comic book that you ever read, because you and I are close in age, I think. Affect you? How did that?
It made me think that every book I read after was going to be as good as that.
I kept getting
disappointed. It allowed me to actually identify what books sucked writing wise, even though I didn't really know like the writing, like. I just kind of instinctually could tell, like, after I read smaller books or other graphic novels, like, if the writing wasn't there, I would kind of know. I would never admit it to myself fully, though, because I loved every comic book I read.
Sure, sure.
But it kind of did that.
Can you imagine the poor bastard that picked up, like, Watchmen as their first comic?
No, you wouldn't have been able to handle it, I don't think. I mean, at my age, the age that I read Dark Knight at, and I remember getting the second issue... before any of them, because I didn't know what it was. I was young, so I didn't know what this was. I just saw, Batman, and I know that they'd been talking about it on the news a little bit, and I remember them reading it, and I, having read other comics, having been a big John Byrne fan, and Captain Carrot and his amazing Zoo Crew when I was younger, and, Justice League and all that stuff, the Spider-Man... And then reading that, just And I'll fully admit that either I wasn't smart enough or mature enough to know what was going on in the book, you know?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I was just like, what is this? And the art is really weird. And what is Batman doing? And yeah, so that must have been an amazing experience, Ian.
It was great. So yeah, it was phenomenal. And so as time went on, my collection grew. You know, I started to brush up against other books that definitely spoke to comics and cultural significance. And a few of those examples were, even though it's not a comic book, a book called The Haunted Smile, which was about stand-up comics that happened to be Jewish. And then there was another book my aunt got me called Up, Up, and Oy Vey, which is actually a rabbi. This is crazy. This guy's a rabbi, but he was really into comics. And he wrote about all the characters that were either Jewish or created by Jewish creators. So,
yeah, which is a lot. Yeah.
It's a long list. It's a pretty long list. So after those books went by, I stumbled onto the 10-cent plague. And it's pretty unassuming because, you know, it's just a little paperback, at least the one that I saw and picked up. And I found it at this local comic shop. Like I said, it was by the Scott McCloud books. So instantly the book, you know, had my approval. Because if you know, most people that do or don't know Scott McCloud, his books are about, a lot of them, not Zot, but he has a whole series of books about comics and how to talk about comics and the theory of comics. So I was instantly like, this has got to be good. It's next to the Scott McCloud stuff. So
good placement.
Great placement. It took about 50 pages to get into the 10-cent plague, but once I got past those initial 50 pages, I became addicted to the book because it revealed really harsh realities about comics, and it also shed light on the timeline of how comics grew up in America. So I should mention that this is really focused on comics in America, and it touches on topics of nuclear family and socio-economical status, politics, religion, touches on pretty much every topic that you'd figure comics would not have a business being part of. So, you know, typically when you pick up an Iron Man, you're not thinking it's going to talk about, you know, the political state of America, which it's not. But like, I guess because it's a novel, you know, it's commenting on how comics was really entwined, and pretty much it was, I don't want to ruin a lot of the book, but or spoil anything, but it just, comics were on, you know, the mind of Congress, and it was something that was being spoke about as being bad.
Yeah.
Well, you know, comics were bad.
Well, I don't think that you're ruining it for anyone to, you know,
okay.
Because it's, you know, this is part of our history here, you know. We've got
sure.
The whole comics code and Frederick Wertham and how all of that stuff sort of came about. You know, even if people don't know about it, you know, the information's out there for them to find out about.
Yeah. But this is all a byproduct of the Red Scare, correct? I mean, is that what it basically deals with?
Yeah, there's some of that in there, but there's also, this talks about before the Comics Code. So there was a whole time before the Comics Code that comics were coming out where it was straight up, it was kids murdering themselves, very graphically murdering other kids, you know, beating up parents. There was domestic abuse. There was.
So it was the Hunger Games.
No
holds
barred. Exactly. It was more graphic than that. So let's see. After reading, you know, the book, I became smarter about how comics were made, and I was able to theorize that, at least now, that the reason maybe comic culture has become so popular today is that because comics have really outgrown this shady, quote-unquote, shady past. So if you love reading or talking about, or if you love collecting comics, this book is for you. And it will give you insight into history that you never knew existed, but did, obviously, like we just said, before the Comics Code was created. So the only, I guess, disclaimer is this book does not focus on the art of creating comics. Rather, it gives an account of the life of early American comic books, their themes, and their perceptions by the good citizens of the United States. So the 10-cent plague is written by David Hajdu, and it can be found at his website, davidhajdu.com.
So
there you go.
Yeah, and basically what this is dealing with, as far as I know, I have not read the book, but I have read a lot about the history of comics in general. And this is has to do with the pre-code era, correct? And then when it all kind of comes to a head, because as you said, there was a time in comic book history where sort of it was unregulated. I mean, it was basically like you could do whatever you wanted almost to a certain extent. I mean, they knew they were going out to kids, but that didn't really stop certain publishers, mainly EC Comics, right, from just engaging in all kinds of, not just genres, but, you know, the types of, I guess, quote unquote, depravity that, you know, you could engage in, like with horror stories or crime stories and that thing. And there's a lot of people that don't know, who don't read comics, that don't know that comics weren't always just superheroes. There was Western and crime and horror, and they would push the envelope of what they could do, you know, because they weren't being watched or regulated. So it deals with that sort of thing, right?
And there's a whole slew of pre-code movies too that were, you know, that are similar. They have more adult topics than you know, than generally people give credit for you know, for that time before the in film it was the Hays Code that came in to to regulate that. But film never really got the chance to push the same envelopes that comics did, because they were very limited by you know, by their technology at the time. And whereas, you know, comics could just go all out, and you could, you know, you could have severed heads and things like that and show that. Whereas, you know, movies didn't get the chance to really follow through with that until what, the 60s, 70s?
Yeah. Well, I mean, pre-code film, I mean, we're talking about sort of the silent era, correct? When things, if you look at the history,
there's some early talks. Yeah, some early talkies that are pre-code too.
Yeah, but a lot of the silent era, if you go back and you look, there was a documentary on AMC a long time ago going over the history of film. And I was just really astounded as to what the early history of film, what kind of subject matter they touched upon, and the fact that there were so many women that were involved in the early creation of film in the silent era, like as directors and producers. And they just really grabbed the bull by the horns and just took this. It's just like any new technology, like the internet or whatever, it's that's not being necessarily regulated or watched down upon by you know, the powers that be, is that there was a lot of nudity, a lot of violence in early silent films. They would attack difficult subject matter like drugs and racism and things like that. And people, you know, it was just, they went buck wild, you know, and they just made subjects that were important to them. And not only that, that would get butts in seats in the audiences, you know. So, yeah, I mean, there was a time in the early turn of the century where just all bets were off. And then you get sort of, you know, church groups and things like that, morality groups that start seeing that maybe kids are sneaking into the theaters, or
it's always about the kids. That's that's always the sort of the flag that they fly first is, you know, someone think about the children who are, you know, being exposed to that this stuff. And, you know, like the EC Comics thing, you know, well, look at all the people now who are fans of that stuff now. You know, Stephen King was a big fan of EC stuff.
I love EC. I have a bunch of the hardbound books that I purchased myself, you know, and tracked them down. And it's beautiful. It's some of the best artwork and some of the greatest sort of stories at that time that you're ever going to see. I mean, you take a Golden Age EC book and you lay it against anything, you know, Superman, Batman, what they were doing back then, and it's 10 times better. You can't dispute it, you know.
Hey, Ian, about what time does the book does 10 Cent Plague end?
It goes right up to when superheroes start to get made. So it really goes the whole gambit. Goes right up to present day, which is really cool. And yeah, by the time I was done with it, I was just like, wow. I mean, there's so much religion, and I mean, it just seems as soon as Congress gets involved, everything's gonna just melt. I mean, the EC guy, they were pulling in serious money. They were making good money.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, it's always debatable whether or not you should have a 5-year-old or an 8-year-old kid reading books about, you know, chopping kids up and hanging them from trees.
No. obviously not. Yeah.
but they were making, you know, they were making bang. Then, yeah, the Red Scare got lumped into it. And then you had book burnings where people were bringing their comics to schools and burning them in the parking lot in book piles. So it's kind of opens that door to where you could be like, all right, you know, everything's not this rosy colored path. It's just a great read. You can't go wrong at all with this book if you like comics.
Well, yeah. You've sold me. I'm definitely picking up a copy.
Well, I definitely want to check it out. And I think that there's just so much that people don't know about the history of comics and why things have sort of developed the way they were and why comics are seen as like kids' entertainment, you know, and not necessarily serious adult entertainment. And a lot of that is because of Wortham and, you know, the Red Scare and you know, this quote-unquote protect the children sort of thing, you know, because comics used to be read by everyone. That's the thing. They would roll them up. They weren't necessarily taken seriously as an art form, you know, and the creators weren't necessarily respected for what they could do. But
they were probably on par with like paperback novels.
Yeah, or maybe not even that. But the point is that if you were in World War II, you would get comics and they would be rolled up in your back pocket, or you would be, you know, wherever at your home base or out in the, you know, out in the field, or even during the Korean War. You know, I mean, they were certainly popular enough so that adults were reading them, you know, for a time. So it's just interesting to see, just knowing and not having read the book, but knowing the comics history of, you know, the rise of the comic book and then sort of the decline during the like mid 50s, early 60s, and then sort of how it kind of starts creeping up again, sort of mid or early 80s slowly. And then, you know, once you get to the Dark Knight Returns, Watchmen, there's sort of a whole new revolution there that takes place, right?
Oh, yeah.
I would think so. And, I mean, definitely by that time, too, independent publishing, you know, sort of came into vogue.
Yeah.
You had, like, you know, Richard and Wendy Penny self-publishing ElfQuest during that time, you know, which was a very popular book.
Yeah, oh, yeah. And the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
You know, once self-publishing came in, you know, that really went a long way towards sort of breaking that code that had been in place and sort of led to where we are now.
Yeah.
You know, unfortunately, the mainstream, you know, your Marvel, your DC, pretty much all they cover now is superheroes.
Yeah.
You'll get an occasional book that's sort of off, you know. DC will still sort of roll out the war stories comics every now and again.
Well, DC has Vertigo, so they're doing a lot of interesting stuff there, although from what I understand, that imprint has kind of been struggling in a way to maintain its, you know, relevance within the larger corporate structure. But they have Vertigo, so there's a lot of good stuff on the Vertigo end, you know. But mostly what seems to be, I mean, sticking around has always been superheroes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems to be, and, you know, from a corporate viewpoint, I guess I can understand, because you've got these things and you can put them on T-shirts and you can sell action figures and, you know, why not just keep chugging down that path? But in the long run, it doesn't really help comics as a whole, you know. You just have to take a look at the Japanese, what they've been doing for years, and the Europeans, you know. I mean, there's so many genres, you know, and there's such a respect sort of for quality, whether you look at the Japanese model, which is basically sort of like sweatshop comics in a way, you know. Not everyone gets paid, you know, what Americans get paid. They don't all get to necessarily keep the rights to their characters and stuff. If you're an assistant or you're an inker or you're drawing backgrounds, you don't get credited, you know, versus sort of the European thing where maybe they come out with one book a year or every 6 months, like a hardbound book, but the quality is just beautiful. You know,
yes.
It's unbelievable. Whereas we're sort of stuck on a model of someplace in between, where it's like you got to pump out a book a month, you know.
And speaking of that, I downloaded the Marvel app last week.
Yeah.
For the iPad to see what that was like. It's interesting. They're definitely trying to do iTunes for Marvel comics. Uh-huh. It's very much you have a virtual shop. You can generally see three or four pages of preview for a book. They do have some free books that you can download to sort of check out a series. They tend to be sort of jump on points, you know, where they'll sort of recap the career of the hero or something like that. I haven't actually bought any books other than the free ones yet, because I haven't really found, I just really don't care for most of the Marvel things anymore. And the things that I do like from their back catalog, I already have in paper.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's really interesting to see them attempt to do for comics what iTunes did for music. Although I'm having a feeling, this is my gut instinct just from looking at this app, probably more people are buying through Comixology than through the Marvel app itself.
Yeah.
Because I'm noticing for each book that comes out, there's usually only one or two ratings for it on the Marvel app.
Oh.
The Comixology lets stores, if you have a comic book store, you go to Comixology, get like an affiliate thing with them, which will allow you to have your customers go on and buy the comics. So it's being processed by Comixology, but it's, I guess you're getting a cut of that. So I would think volume wise with, you know, customers, you're probably going to get more. I agree with you, Paul, that people are probably hitting Comixology more at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, until, because then you have to think, well, how many kids have iPads, and what, you know, the customer breakdown of like the, you know, the geopolitical breakdown of how many comics people have iPads to read all their comics too.
Right.
Right.
So far, the nicest thing I've seen about the Marvel app is that it's cloud storage. So if you buy an issue on it, you can read it on your iPad or your phone or something like that. So you don't have to, you know, let's say you're stuck somewhere, you can just pull out your phone and browse the issue and read your comic there. So it's, the portability is very nice.
Yeah.
I'm just not really sold right now on Marvel's books.
Ouch. That hurts. But
yeah, I tried the preview issue of the Avengers versus X-Men, and you know, I don't really like the way that they're setting it up. It's almost like they're setting it up like it's a game. They assign roles.
Did you try the augmented reality?
No, I haven't tried the augmented reality yet.
I'm only assuming that would be if you bought the print copy, right? The augmented reality, correct?
I have no idea, man.
You have no idea.
I just went through the one that that they had on the, you know, on the Marvel site, and I mean, you know, I understand, you know, they're making another big event thing here. Ooh, you know, the Phoenix is coming back to Earth. I mean, it's pretty clear that they're setting up one of their newer characters to be the new Phoenix. But, you know, I don't know. It's just too gimmicky for me to really get into when they've got the teams broken down and, you know, they've got, you know, Hulk assigned as, you know, his role is that he's a tank. And, you know, Captain America's role is that he is a commander of these forces, and some people are quick strike. I mean, it seems very, again, structured like it's going to be sort of a game that is put together. And
so you read the preview. You read what, number zero?
Yeah,
number zero, and that they were giving that away for free.
No, they gave another one away for free, and then there's issue zero, and then there's issue one. I mean,
okay,
and that sort of ties into my I guess, old man hatred of all of these things too, is that, you know, I just want a good story from beginning to end.
And that's a good reason these days to, you know, go the independent route, quite honestly. I mean, you know, but we totally got off track of like the 10 cent plague, which is fine. You know, we're here to talk about whatever, but I mean, so Ian recommends the book, and I would recommend.
I was pretty much done. That was a good. I thought that was a really smooth transition, because
I would say, you know, pick up The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay as well.
Oh yeah, I read that too. That's a great one.
That is an amazing book. Obviously, it's been out for years, but if anybody has not read it, pick that up as well. And that would probably be a good like double read on a vacation. Like if you were going away, I don't know if it'd be too much Golden Age overdose.
By yourself.
Yeah, by yourself, and everybody leave you alone. But that's great. But so like the Marvel, it's on my pull list. X-Men versus Avengers, or Avengers versus X-Men, whatever it's called. I added it just because I was curious.
A versus X.
A versus X. Well, you know, that's the thing is, quite honestly, and I'm just going to blow it here on the podcast. I mean, I work for Disney/Marvel. So
what?
I can't. I know. It's a secret. It's quiet. It's a secret. But that's the thing is, I can't overly criticize, you know. You know, I want to keep my job. But you guys can have your opinion, whatever. But I can't really say whether I hate it or not. You know, on Ain't It Cool, I don't review Marvel books. You know,
But I want to ask Paul. So, Paul, are you, based on the setup you just talked about, are they just skewing it way young, or they're just skewing it for complete ignorance, in your opinion?
It's weird because they're not really skewing it young. I mean, they are sort of tying it to the current geopolitical climate in a way, because you've got the Avengers dealing with this as sort of a national security threat, you know, the idea of the Phoenix coming to Earth being a national security threat. It's not that it's going young, it's just that it seems that, again, the comparison I have for it is that it feels like they're setting it up sort of like it's a board game in a way.
Well,
that sounds really weird.
From what I understand, the way they're setting it up, and I haven't read any of it, I can't say whether, I saw some of the Frank Cho artwork for, I think, issue zero, and I thought
it's
that
pretty.
Was gorgeous, gorgeous artwork. I mean, he's an amazing artist. But from what I understand, like, the main story is sort of going to take place in the main book, the first 12 issues, and then any, like, fights, like, huge sort of takedowns are going to take place, like, in the main books. So I guess if, like, Thor faces down Colossus or something, I don't know. I don't even know if Colossus is still in the X-Men books. I haven't really read them
in a long
time.
Yeah, he is, but he's wearing the Juggernaut helmet, and he's shaved his head.
What?
I'm not commenting on that. I can't I can't comment. You're killing me. I can't say anything. Let's talk DC. No, I just... oh, my goodness. Wow. Okay, I'm going to have to check that out.
Part of it, too, may be the fact that, like, I just haven't kept up on Marvel's books enough to really appreciate what they're trying to do.
Well, it's very interesting because there's this guy who reviews comics on Ain't It Cool. His name is, his handle is Professor Challenger. And on Facebook, he posts a lot, and he posts, you know, interesting links every once in a while. And he posted a sales link, and it said that Aquaman was outselling X-Men. And I basically posted, I don't want to live in that world. And he basically posted back, he said, Suicide Watch at the Horn household, you know. And I was just like, he talks to the fishes. He talks to fish. You're trying to tell me that a guy that talks to fish is outselling X-Men? But it's got to be noted
that... Not the writing, Christian.
But it's also got to be noted that the X-Men books are at $3.99 and the Aquaman books are at $2.99. So... that could have something to do with it as well. I mean, I think that the price point of comics is outrageous at this point anyway. I mean, I read a lot of indie books, and Image has been keeping their price point down to $2.99, but Boom and IDW, all their books are at $4. And I like their books. They have really good artists, and they have really good, you know, creators on there. And, you know, the quality of their books are really nice. But it's getting harder and harder for me to justify $3.99 for a pamphlet book, you know?
Well, yeah, you remember at WonderCon how I said I felt like everything there was just slightly over the price point that I felt comfortable with paying.
Yeah, yeah.
Just books, but, you know, posters, artwork, T-shirts, everything has just sort of gotten... And I realized that part of it's the economy, people having to charge more in order to make a profit. But, yeah, it's a lot of potential fans end up getting sort of priced out of the market.
I mean, I can't disagree
No, I think it's one of those things where you have the industry in this weirdo balancing act. They still got to keep up the physical sales. They've got to launch the digital stuff. And as that happens, the physical stuff will go up. The digital stuff will be whatever it's going to be. And it's just an in-between point. Maybe it just stays like this for a long time until something happens. It's going to have to, because I think the industry is in a really in-between space right now.
Yeah. It's really interesting to me because, quite honestly, when we were at WonderCon, I ran into an artist who's drawing a book called, I think it's called Valen the Outcast from Boom Studios, right? And I was looking at his artwork, and I cannot remember his name, but I'll post a link on the site if I can find a website for the guy. And the art, his art was gorgeous. I mean, it was kinetic. It was well-structured. The panel construction was beautiful. And I just sat there just staring at it like, this is beautiful artwork. And I was leafing through his originals, and I basically asked him, I said, what is this from? And he said, it's from this book, Valen the Outcast, and you can go pick it up at the Boom Studios booth. And so before I left, because Boom Studios was on the way to the exit, you know, the first issue is $1, but every issue after that is $3.99. And when I was at WonderCon, I bought the first issue because I was not willing to take a chance on the other three issues that followed it right away. You know, and it's very smart of them to make the first issue $1. But mm-hmm. I would have bought the whole stack if there had been a bargain, or if they had been $2.99, or possibly, you know, $1.99 per book. And the thing is Boom Studios books, the cards, the paper stock is gorgeous. It's glossy. But why do that? Can't you save some costs on just give me a newsprint book and it'll be just as beautiful, I think, with the printing technology as the glossy paper stock. I mean, it may not be just as beautiful, but good enough. And I think that a lot of us have become obsessed with that it's got to be the highest, absolutely highest quality possible. And
which is certainly not how this how comics started.
No, and it doesn't need to be. Like, I was just at Costco this morning. I had to return a laptop because we bought...
Sounds fun.
It was awesome. It was just the greatest thing ever. I had to return a laptop for Amy because we bought her a new laptop. And I was looking at a different laptop because we had returned it and gotten our money. And I was going to go... I wanted to look for something else because Amy really needs something because the thing that she's on now is like a dinosaur. There's squirrels on wheels inside the machine running the thing. But... like, honestly, I'm sitting there, and there was a Samsung tablet, okay, on sale. And this guy was there with his two kids. And he picks it up, and he's like, oh, look at this, you know, showing his kids. Like, and the price was good. It was like $4.29 for a Samsung tablet. And those Samsung tablets are supposed to be pretty good. And he picks it up, and he shows it to his kids, and he's like, oh, this is good. And his kids are like, the iPad is better, Dad. And I was sitting there looking at him, and I said to him, the iPad 3 is better. And he stopped and he looked at me, and I said, but it depends on what you're looking for. Like, because this is a high def screen. It's like 19, whatever high def off the top of my head, you know, and it streams, and it's an Android tablet, and it's not as good. The resolution is not as good as an iPad 3, but it's still really good. It's still good, you know? And so I got into this conversation with him, and it was really funny because he completely turned his back on his teenage kids. And he started talking to me like, and we were starting to have a conversation. And he was like, oh, this guy's intelligent. This guy knows where I'm at because I'm a family guy and I got to save money. And I can't just, and he's like, oh, I saw the iPad at the store and it was $600. And I'm like, yeah, you got to decide what is worth the money. And is super glossy ultra paper stock worth the money? It's not. To me, it's not. Maybe to other people it is, but to me, that's a waste of money. That is a complete waste of cash.
You're right. No, you're right, Christian. But I think the industry got itself into trouble when every jack monkey decided they got to have a die cut triple gloss cover. and at that point in the late 90s, they started just sticking with, oh, why don't we upgrade this stock? I remember on the Legends of the Dark Knight, which I was a huge fan of.
Oh, yeah.
And Reddit episode one, they started doing this kind of deluxe book with, and it had shiny paper, and it sold, I think it did pretty well because, you know, they had different teams on it all the time, but it's almost like, and let's face it, the industry was making a killing. It's almost like they were cashing in all their chips at that point.
Yeah.
They spent all of this money on this great archival acid-free paper and everything.
Right.
So you've got a bunch of the shittiest books imaginable from the late 80s to early 90s. You know, that are never going to go away because they're like perfectly preserved.
Right. Yeah. And the industry could afford it then because they were making tons of profits. But what happens is when something ships, it's almost like they're just stuck there now. Like, well, if we go back and, you know, because those books were still cheaper though. It was still, yeah, it was maybe $2 or it was maybe $2.50. I guess what I'm saying is they kind of produced themselves into a corner. So they raised it up thinking that's going to be the profit point. And I know business is business, but I never understood the thing every year where it's like, great job, you made $10 million. Next year, you got to make $15 million.
Yeah, that's
and I never, every year, every corporation decides, well, here's the prospectus for this year. Yeah. You got to now make, so how are you going to do that?
Yeah, it's a whole other that's a whole other conversation. And what's really interesting, though, I mean, we could get into corporate, but this is not a political podcast. I mean, but the thing is like the 90s, it was a different time. The economy was different. Everything was different. And people were willing to take chances on comic books, you know, back then. And they got caught up in the speculator boom. And the reasons for the boom were much different. And the things that were happening in the comic industry were much different than what is happening today. Like today, you just need to get new readers. And it doesn't seem like that's
right
necessarily what's happening. And right. What's very interesting to me is you keep seeing these reports of like, sales are great. Sales are great. The new 52, sales are fantastic. But the thing is the argument that I keep making is that comic industry sales are not based on who's actually you and me going in and buying. It's based on orders from the stores. You know what I'm saying? So you go into a comic book store and you still see like tons of 52, the new 52 issues sitting around.
Right.
Nobody's buying them. You know, so it's sort of like a false, you know, a false definition on how the industry is growing.
New readers are reading books, not reading comic books now. I mean, you have a much huger fan base of something like, say, Hunger Games or Twilight or something like that than you do for comics.
Yeah.
And young adult literature has sort of taken the place of comics as what's popular.
Yeah,
I agree. And I think you got the movies now, though, too. You know, you got Stan Lee, who it's kind of like a garage sale. I don't even know if he's in charge of it anymore, but all the characters that are coming out into movies, the studios are, you know, in some part making money on. I know, you know, DC's very happy with everything Dark Knight's doing. So they have all this other revenue happening in a way.
Yeah.
And the animated stuff, the animated series weren't really, I mean, it was Dark Knight, right? Was the animated show back, I guess, then. But you have all that stuff happening too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the thing, is that the comics are not necessarily driving it anymore. You know, you've got movies,
right.
You've got the animated shows, you've got toys. It's not like it was when we were little kids. And, you know, I mean, it sounds like an old man thing, but it really isn't. And that's the thing, is are they grabbing young people to buy their product? I mean, I don't know. Anytime I go to Target, I see DC action figures. I see Marvel action figures. It does sound fun. I mean, if kids are so lucky today, I mean, I sound like an old man, but when I see the stuff that's coming out, you know, I'm like, I would have died for a Captain America figure when I was a kid that looked that good, that was as well produced as the stuff. And that has to do with the whole other, you know, trade barriers opening up and China, other, you know, other things than actual comics market. But I'm just curious to, I mean, it seems like everything's going well for those companies. And what's interesting is that I know that there's either a talkbacker on Ain't It Cool or one of the reviewers that keeps saying, like, the comics should just be a marketing ploy at this point. They should just be stories that they push out to support the actual money that you're going to get from the movies, from the, so those price points should be as low as possible, if not free, you know, so that you can draw in the people who are going to buy the action figures or the DVDs or the digital downloads or whatever it is, you know.
Well, that's what the animated shows, that's the purpose that the animated shows served for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they probably still do. I mean, Young Justice, right? And this new Green Lantern cartoon.
And of course, you've got Avengers.
Yeah. Oh, the Avengers. It starts today. I haven't watched it yet. That's such a good show. Oh my gosh, I couldn't believe
do you know if it already aired or
I think the premiere episode of that and the new Ultimate Spider-Man cartoon aired today, which is Sunday, which is when we're recording. And but the Avengers, I mean, I don't know if Ian has seen it yet, but I know Paul, you told me that it was really good, and I gotta say I loved it. I could not believe how much I loved that cartoon. I was not expecting much out of the first episode, but I stuck with it, and it just stuck to such the classical comics, the way they were. They followed the DC model to a certain extent, which is like, we're going to stick with what happens in the comics and we're going to kind of follow that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was very happy with that. But yeah, I just think that we'll see how it goes. There's going to be a breaking point. Something's got to happen. You know what I mean? And I know that the recession wiped out a bunch of comic book shops. But I don't know. It's really weird the way things are going. But I don't know. I don't know. We keep talking about this. It's we should just name it the Bitch About Comics podcast.
Hey, Christian, yeah. You saw John Carter.
I did see John Carter. And I saw John Carter yesterday. I finally got a chance to see it. And again, I was going to say it anyway. I'm a Disney employee, okay? So take it for what it's worth. But you guys know me. I am, like, I will break something down if I have to. Like, if I don't like it, you know, I'm limited in my criticism of Disney Marvel stuff on this podcast. I'm just going to say it. And on anything else that I do, because, you know, it's not that I'm not being honest or, but it's just, I have a job. I love my job. I love the company and the people that I work for. And I love my family. So that being said, all right, John Carter. I loved it. I know Ian didn't like it so much or wasn't crazy about it, but I, like, there were a couple of things that bugged me about it, but there was just so much in there that I just tacked onto, and I was just like, this is great. Like, it's so imaginative, and it had so much, like, heart to me. It made me cry. Okay, the scene where he goes in and fights the aliens and he's starting to remember about his wife and his daughter.
Yes.
Like, I cried, okay? I cried. And I don't know, maybe it was early in the morning and my emotional defenses were... But what was that?
You cried.
I cried.
I loved it.
Yes, I cried. I loved it. I thought the relationship between John Carter and Deja Thoris was really well developed and established, and I felt that the relationship between him and the lead, what were they, Tharks, was really beautifully well done. I thought that it was just really well paced and well thought out. It was not the Transformers. It was not even Avatar, which I didn't like as much as I like this. You know, I and people are going to be like, oh, that guy's crazy. He liked this more than Avatar. And
No, I liked it so much more than Avatar.
Because I just felt like it
look,
just...
Look, the Edgar Rice Burroughs Mars books were some of the first books that I ever read.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I had a real history with the stuff going in. So I, once I sort of got over the fact that Mars didn't look like I had imagined it to look when I was, you know, 8, 9 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
I really, really enjoyed it. They really, I thought they developed a good character out of John Carter, which was never really established in the books.
Oh, really?
In the books, he's not much of a character. Same with Tarzan. I mean, he's, you know, he's basically, he's the Wolverine, you know, he's the best he is at what he does. And like, yeah. That's the purpose that he serves. But no, they really did get to the heart of the friendships and the relationships that make Mars work. And I enjoyed it a lot too.
Look, I'll tell you this, and we could get Ian's reactions in a second if he wants to talk. It sounds like he's like dumbfounded by our love for the movie.
I'm shocked.
But
I'm shocked right now.
But here's the thing is that when I was done and I met up with my wife, she said, "How was the movie?" And I said, "I really, really, really liked it." And it and I said to her, "It was sitter worthy," which basically means, you know, I went to see it
wow.
by myself. It means that I would have said, let's get a sitter and go. The bad word of mouth was like Amy said, oh, should we go see that? Should we get a sitter? I said, no, you know, I'll go see it by myself at some point. You know, we have to pay for it. Was sitter worthy to me. Amy would have really liked it because of Dasia Thoris. I thought like
yes.
her character was perfect. And she's Wonder Woman. Paul, you're right. If Warner
yep.
Brothers does not get on that right away, like she's Wonder Woman and she looks like a woman. She doesn't look like a teenager and she's got muscles and she's not like stick thin and she's beautiful.
And
you know?
She's got a personality
yeah.
too.
Yeah. She had a viewpoint. Like she stuck up for what like in the opening scene where she first shows up and she's like practicing a speech, I thought, okay, this is a little awkward. This is very much like Disney princess, you know. Oh, I'm trying to, you know, pitch myself to my father, blah, blah, blah. But once it went on, like, it just kept going. I just fell in love with that character, which I don't know if she's that deep in the books. And the other thing is, I literally left the theater, went downstairs to the Barnes & Noble in the mall that I saw it in, and bought the books. I bought the trilogy. And I started reading them last night, and I like them so far. I've read the first, like, three chapters, and I think it's great. So... I don't know.
I'm curious what Ian thinks.
I want to know what Ian thinks.
I want to hear the opposite opinion here.
But no, Ian, let me ask you first. Did you see it in 3D?
I saw it in 3D IMAX.
Okay, that's the problem, Ian. Because you and I just may have different tastes. But I really feel that you like 3D. I can't stand 3D. Because I think that
no,
it
takes... I don't like...
You don't like 3D?
Don't... What? No, I wasn't going to – I think it was Hugo that brought me back to 3D because I was in the theater buying tickets for Hugo. I'm like, wait a minute. Why does it only say 3D? Can't I just see the plain, you know,
yeah, yeah.
movie?
Yeah, yeah.
And we're like, no. Anyway, that was so well done. You know, I was like, okay. So, you know, John Carter happened. I went with Heidi's brother and his son. So I'm like, all right, they're going to go to IMAX 3D first show. Century City, I'm like, I'm going to do it because I really wanted to see John Carter. I think it's a great thing. Anyway, I don't know. Maybe early in the morning, I'm the opposite. Like, I was, like, struggling to keep awake, and the child next to me was struggling, and his dad was struggling, and it just didn't go down the right way.
Wow, really?
And it's not because this is not the kind of movie where at least I walk out and say, oh, it sucked and it was awful and it was bad. Like they're trying. There's movies you go see where you're like, that sucked.
Yeah.
And that sucked because they just really were trying to steal my money.
Yeah.
This was like, I just didn't. Something happened story wise behind the scenes where I just, it didn't. All the points you make are actually there. But at the same time, I'm like, man, I did not like the acting in it at all.
Really?
I thought the guy who played John Carter was like sleeping.
No way. I completely disagree. I gotta disagree. I got it. The guy
Zero charisma. No,
I don't think
he's no Sam Worthington.
No, I think
even less charisma there.
Yeah, of course. Sam Worthington is basically a paper doll that you basically put a costume on and he walks through the movie and does what the director tells him what to do, right? That's Sam Worthington. But this guy, in the very beginning, I had a little bit of a hard time believing him, but as the movie went on, I was just very impressed with how he was reacting to aliens that weren't there, you know. And I was very impressed with the guy and his interplay with, I don't know the actress's name, but again, Deja Thoris, I could say that name a billion times over. He clicked. At some point, it was like, bam, snap. And I was like, okay, I'm in this. Now, I know that somebody who was a really big fan of the novel said to me, which is the same thing that I had in the reaction of The Dark Knight, which is basically like, mm-hmm. that's a really good Joker. It's not my Joker, but it's a really good Joker. Right. And this guy said to me, he's a big fan of Burroughs, and he said, that guy did a really good John Carter. It's not my John Carter, but he pulled it off with what he was able to do.
You know, Christian, the thing about John Carter and Tarzan and, you know, pretty much any one of Burroughs' male characters from that he wrote is that they're definitely sort of wish fulfillment figures that you sort of project yourself into.
Gotcha. Okay.
So I can see where people would have sort of trouble with that. As a matter of fact, like I said, that's why I thought it was interesting. They brought out sort of a character that wasn't really there to begin with.
Yeah. Well, they must have developed it for the script. I mean, I know just from the opening that they changed the opening of the book.
Yes.
A lot. And
yes. Well, because you know, falling asleep and suddenly waking up on Mars doesn't really fly with its audiences.
Well, yeah, it's really weird. And of course, there's all that Native American sort of slightly racist, savage stuff in the beginning of the book. It's not too harsh.
Burroughs not known for his racial sensitivity.
Well, was anybody at that time? I don't think so. But Ian, I got to tell you, when it comes out on Blu-ray or whatever, rent it again and sit and watch it, because I don't know. Maybe it's not the 3D or the story or the time of the day that you saw it in, but I'm going to buy this when it comes out on Blu-ray. And people are like, oh, he's...
I'm glad you are. But, dude, the strongest character on screen was the alien dog, Woola.
No, I disagree. Yes. I disagree.
He was a dog. Yes. He was a dog, you know? I mean, he was very much a dog. I mean, you know, and dogs have plenty of character as it is.
That was the bright spot in the film for me.
Really?
I thought the female lead had a really good part, but again, I thought everything about her to me fell flat. She'd make a great Wonder Woman, but I just could not get into their relationship at all.
That is amazing. I feel so bad for Andrew Staten, because that's his name, right? I probably have his last name. The guy directed my favorite Pixar movie of all time, which is Finding Nemo, and then he directed my second, I don't know if it's my second favorite, but it's up there, which is WALL-E. And I hope that he is not put in live action directing jail, you know, because I think the guy did a great job. I really do. And I know a lot of people are there, well, wait, your favorite Pixar movie is not The Incredibles? And no, it's not, because I think The Incredibles, as brilliant as it is, basically tacked on to things that have been around for 70 years. Whereas, like, something like Finding Nemo, it's a story about fish. How do you make that interesting? Like, I don't, you know, when I saw Finding Nemo, I was like, this is a work of genius. This is genius. Like, hands down. Whoever did this pulled it off. And so now I just feel bad that, you know, I heard a guy on NPR saying that it's the Ishtar of the 2000s or whatever.
No, see, that's going overboard. It's
big
not,
time.
It box office wise, it might be. It's not that bad. I think people overreacted to slaying it. It's just one of those. It's a I think it's a very unique story, you know, because it actually is.
Yeah.
And I think we've been spoiled. The book was never picked up a lot sooner.
Yeah.
And basically all the derivative works we've seen from it are awesome.
Yeah.
But in reality, this is like the source. This is like the Bible for a lot of stuff that we've watched.
Yeah.
And they picked it apart. And the original, at this point, we're like, oh, yeah, we've seen that, not knowing that we've seen a derivative of John Carter.
Yeah.
So
that's the thing,
there's
though.
That, too.
It has legs to a certain extent, too, because, I mean, Christian, you just saw this, and it's been out for over a month.
Yeah. Well, again, I went to an early morning show because that's the only time I can really get away by myself. My wife takes my daughter to ballet class on Saturday mornings, and so that's when I was like, okay, I'm just going to go see this movie. And the theater was not full by any means, obviously. I mean, it's a bad showtime mm-hmm. or whatever. But I will say that if Peter Jackson can make three movies for $300 million, but the money for me was there on the screen. I don't know if $250 million worth of money was on the screen, but I was just...
that's an inflated budget, too, based on all the sort of previous aborted attempts, you know, that they've had of this, too.
Pisses me off, because that pisses
me
off.
It's like Superman Returns had such a high budget because of all the, you know, previous stuff that had gone on with that.
So are you saying to me that the reason that people are saying this is a $250 million budget is because of all the pre-production, like Rodriguez's version, and, well, maybe not Rodriguez's version, because it was with Paramount for a long time, and then Paramount let the rights lapse, and then Disney picked it up. So are you saying, do you think that $250 million is not strictly from the Disney budget, but also the Paramount budget?
I would probably think so.
Oh, my God. Well, Stanton is getting a raw deal. He's getting a raw deal. I mean, I think this is a really good movie. Ian and I agree to disagree, I guess. But
yeah,
I was just blown away. And I do not like stuff like the Transformers. I hated the first Transformers. It's a horrible movie. I did not see the other two after it. And I thought Avatar was great, but look, if Avatar is making $1 billion, you know, there's no reason that this movie should not be making at least its budget back. It doesn't have to be a $1 billion movie, but are you kidding me? This is just as good, if not better, to me. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the 3D was like, because I refuse to see 3D movies. I hate 3D movies, but in any case, I liked it. Ian didn't like it. Paul liked it. I loved it. I'm going to go so far as to say I loved it. I just enjoyed it. Maybe I don't get out of the house enough. I don't know. It could be. But I got to say, Ian, did you see Wrath of the Titans?
I came so close to ducking out of work on Friday.
Don't say that on the podcast.
Because I work. Well, I don't work for Disney or anyone who made Wrath of the Titans. But,
no, but I'm saying, you know, ducking out of work, that's not good.
my boss doesn't listen to this. It was a slow day, and I work across the street from the Grauman's Chinese Theater.
Oh, really?
And I'm like, all right. Yeah, my boss left early for the day, and I'm like, this will be perfect. I'll go, and I'll sneak in there, and I'll watch some Wrath of the Titans, because I love monsters, and they're really pushing the monster posters here. And, the remake stunk. I couldn't stand the remake. But I'm a sucker for more monsters, and they're loading this thing up with monsters, and I'm like, yes. And I'm like, let me just jump to Rotten Tomatoes and see what the fans say. And I should not have done that, because the fans and the reviewers alike were like, this movie stink. How could this be? How could this movie stink when there's monsters in it? You know, and I know monsters aren't for everybody, but typically, you know, there are some movies I will just go see. Like, usually, I missed the last Underworld movie, but I watched all of those, and I just love them simply because it's an Underworld movie, and there's vampires fighting werewolves. That's all I need. So
that's awesome.
I was in the same vein for this, but there was not really any glimmer of, like, you know, if you really like monster movies, you'll like Wrath of... It was pretty much like, there's too much subwoofer bass. There is too much CGI. You will be exhausted after about, 30 minutes of watching this movie. And I didn't want to feel that way because I hate going to the movies and walking out exhausted. And it happens a lot these days, not because of my lack of sleep or anything, but because you get assaulted. And I didn't want to get assaulted. I wanted to see monsters fight. And I didn't go. It's a long story, I didn't go.
Well, it's interesting because I was going to go see it with a friend of mine, and then I looked at the reviews on Rotten Tomatoes again.
Exactly.
And I was like, you know what? Exactly. This may be a cable movie for me, which the first one was. I saw it on cable in high def, and I ended up enjoying it, not loving it, but thinking like, it's okay. I don't know, whatever. It is what it is. It's not absolutely horrible. It's not Transformers, which... is my base at this point, but my bottom rung.
That's a good place to set the bar right there. Because, my story with Transformers was, my mom had broken her arm, and I had to go take care of her for a few weeks out in Las Vegas, and it was just, it was really, really difficult. It was terrible, but I did get a couple of hours off, and I had the chance to get out of the house, so I went and I saw Transformers, and I wish that I had stayed at home changing the pants.
Oh, man. That's messed up. All right, so we did not see Wrath of the Titans. Maybe we can review it when it comes out on DVD or Blu-ray, or if somebody changes their mind. But we have reached the hour point. This is Part-Time Fanboy, and I am Christian, and that is Paul, and that is Ian, and thanks for listening. Take care.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
Christian.
Mark. Oh, yeah, doing part-time. Oh, yeah, doing part-time.